Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Is the internet making us dumb? Nicholas Carr and a lot of new research say maybe so, chipping away at our ability to read and think deeply, rewiring our very brains to skip along the surface of information ideas, striking at the heart of the concentration required for creativity. So could the internet and our new wired world be a net negative? We'll look at the argument and hear pushback in today's hour. If we can hold your attention. This hour, On Point, our brains in the wired world. Joining me now from Boulder, Colorado, is Nicholas Carr. His new book is The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, which expands on his widely discussed 2008 Atlantic article, Is Google Making Us Stupid? You can read an excerpt from the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Nicholas Carr, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Everybody's got an opinion on this. You pulled together a lot of research. What's some of the most compelling research you found that says we're being changed and not in a good way by our wired lives?
There's been, over the last 10, 15 years, a lot of research on different aspects of computer use and in particular, internet use. And so research that looks at, for instance, the difference in learning and comprehension when we read hypertext, the type of text sprinkled with links online, versus linear text like you'd find in a book. And it's found, the preponderance of it is found that comprehension goes down as we begin to put links and we begin to, particularly when we begin to click on links. And then there's also a lot of research now on the kind of multimedia we experience when we go online. So it's not just text. There's also advertisements and video streams and audio streams. And all of these things break our attention in a way that also reduces comprehension, reduces understanding. Then there's a lot of course, a lot of research on online multitasking. What happens when we juggle lots of tasks? And there's a lot of research on interruptions and distractions. What happens when we, you know, check our email inbox every 15 seconds or follow headlines or tweets or stuff? And when you put all of this research together, you see, I think, a pretty clear picture that the internet is encouraging more superficial thought. It gives us tons of stuff to look at, tons of new information to see, but it's training us, I would argue, at a very deep cognitive level to skip around on it from one bit of information to the next and never slow down, pay attention, think deeply.
The kind of, I don't know what it is, allegation or picture painted here is really disturbing. You quote Patricia Greenfield, she wrote in Science last year, a big developmental psychologist, saying that growing use of screen-based media has been accompanied by, quoting her, new weaknesses in higher order cognitive processes, including abstract vocabulary, mindfulness, reflection, inductive problem solving, critical thinking, and imagination. Those sound like the crown jewels.
For me, they do. They sound like the types of elements of thought that traditionally, at least, we've used to define a rich intellectual life. And to be fair, she also points out that the research indicates that net use might help certain other cognitive functions improve them, things like hand-eye coordination, our ability to follow lots of images on screen simultaneously. And you know, those are important, particularly if you're, you know, going to be a traffic controller or something. And we shouldn't lose sight of those. But still, if you look at the areas of thought that seem to be diminished by the use of the web, as I say, they're the ones that I think define the best things we can do with our minds.
I mean, we only need so many air traffic controllers and, I don't know, predator drone remote pilots. So you're not talking here about people who are occasionally on the web looking for this or that. You're talking about a kind of very contemporary, fellow citizen, that if we're really getting into talking about changes in the brain itself, must be quite wired up. I mean, paint a picture for us of just how wired you're seeing the person affected in this way.
There's been a long-term trend, of course, and most of us know it from our own lives, of spending more and more time either online or receiving emails through our phones or text messages or Twitter tweets or Facebook updates and stuff. And as we spend more and more time online, we begin to what scientists, neuroscientists have found in recent decades is that the brain, the human brain, including the adult brain, adapts very, very easily, actually, to any kind of activity that we repeatedly do.
Mm-hmm. Plasticity is the quality that
permits
that. Right,
neuroplasticity.
Which means our brain changes. It changes in response to what we do, how we live, how we think, how we interact.
Right. Certain neural – if you exercise certain – neural connections, they tend to grow and get stronger. And on the other hand, if you don't exercise them, if you neglect certain elements of thought, those connections begin to weaken and in some cases get repurposed for the things you do more often. So if our habits of mind change, if we spend more time jumping around from web page to web page, handling a bombardment of messages, skimming and scanning, those are the brain functions that are strengthened, and our brain wants to do them more and more because that's the nature of the brain. It wants to keep exercising itself in the way that it has been exercised. And on the other hand, if that activity displaces calmer, more attentive, more contemplative thought, then we begin to lose some of the capacity for that mode of thinking.
Nicholas Carr, you write that you began to witness some of this change in yourself. What did you observe?
Well, I've been a very avid web user and computer user for many years. I certainly know all the benefits we get from the web. But a few years back, 3 or 4 years ago, I started to notice that even when I turned off my computer and sat down, for instance, to read a book or a long article or simply to pay attention to a conversation or to follow one train of thought, my mind continued to be distracted, and I realized what it wanted to do was to do what it did when I am online, which is, you know, change my focus very quickly, click on links, check email, and I began to wonder, you know, is there a connection here? Am I losing some of my capacity for deep reading and deep thinking and deep concentration because I'm spending so much time and doing so many more things online? And so that personal experience, and I began to hear other people when I talked about it mention similar changes in themselves. That led me to look both at some of the history of how technology has shaped human thought and also some of the scientific evidence.
Now, if you go even deeper than history, prehistory, you also make a kind of evolution, an argument out of evolution for why humans may be susceptible to having their brain's plasticity veer toward noticing every new thing that pops up on a screen rather than going deep on a particular idea.
If you think about the way our ancestors, many millennia ago, stayed alive, it was through shifting their attention very, very quickly. You had to be aware of everything going on around you, everything in the environment. You wanted to get an early warning of the approach of a predator. You wanted to make sure you didn't overlook that bush with some tasty berries on it. So I think we're naturally, like many other animals, we're naturally prone to very rapid shifts in focus, to constantly shifting our attention, to not paying attention, to not focusing in on one thing. So this is very natural to the human brain. And what I argue is that we've been shaped in many ways, the way we think, by the technologies we use to gather information. And so, for instance, I think that much of our ability to concentrate, to pay attention to one thing, to follow a single train of thought, can be linked to the growing use of books.
Book learning, it was called. Book learning.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the great thing about a printed page, a book page, is there's nothing else going on. It trains you to be focused, to pay attention for hundreds of pages at a time. What I think the net is doing in other related digital technologies is, in a sense, overriding what the book trained us to do, which is to pay attention, to think deeply, in returning us in some ways to our natural state of constantly shifting our attention. This time we're not, you know, looking for approaching predators. We're looking for that next headline or that next Facebook update from a friend of ours. But we're constantly shifting our attention. And another reason for this, and this is pretty clear from the science too, is that we seem to place a very high priority on new information. And I think it's related to the phenomenon I talked to. And so even if the new is trivial, and even if we know it's trivial, we're drawn to that rather than to an existing piece of information we may have already glanced at.
Taking us back to that savanna life, that pre-civilizational life, and that's part of what you're pointing at, the internet takes us everywhere. Nicholas Carr quotes the Roman philosopher Seneca saying 2,000 years ago, to be everywhere is to be nowhere. But of course, you know, Socrates also gets cited, and he lamented the invention of books. They create forgetfulness in the soul, he said, and a lot of people, as you well know, Nicholas, point to this argument and say, at the base of your argument is a kind of nostalgia. Technology also always changes, and we always change with it, and it's been a pretty, line toward progress.
We definitely change with our technology. We definitely adapt to it. I don't point to that as something that should make us complacent. I point to that as something that should make us worried. How are we adapting? How are we changing? What are we becoming? Is this changing us in a way that is good, that leads to deeper, more creative thought? Or is it changing us in a way that makes us more distracted, less able to think deeply and creatively?
Nick Vilton joins us right now as well. Two Nicks today, Nicholas and Nick. Nick Vilton is technology reporter for the New York Times. He's lead writer of the Times Bits blog, adjunct professor at New York University's Interactive Telecommunications Program. His book, I Live in the Future and Here's How It Works, will be released this fall. Nick Vilton, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
You know, a lot of people are plugging into this debate right now, and it really grabs your attention when you're told that your brain itself may be changed by all of our wired interaction and not necessarily changed in a good way. What do you make of the argument and the research that Nicholas Carr cites, Nick?
Well, it's really fascinating. In my book, I look at a lot of the same research and come away with a completely different point of view. I think that Nick really makes a really interesting point, but when you look at a lot of the neuroscience research around video games, for example, you know, we see that our brains are actually they actually work really well with video games, and they offer a really interactive experience for us. Our brains become it increases our memory. We get better with hand-eye coordination and things like that. And I think that the web somewhat offers the same kind of experience. You know, I don't think that it's necessarily that the digital is replacing the long form and long form will completely disappear in the future. I think that it offers a new type of storytelling that offers all these different interactive vocations. So you have, you know, multimedia, and you have words, and you have video, and you have photos, and you have communication with readers and with other people. And I think that that's what we really get out of the web that I think maybe missed in this argument.
But take the video game argument, for example. Nicholas Carr cites some of those positive results, but the kind of mental activity encouraged there, he suggests, may be good if you're going to be an air traffic controller. Or I was thinking, you know, a predator drone pilot. Is it good for thinking through the meaning of life?
Well, I mean, it's also doctors. I mean, there was a study that was done a few years ago with laparoscopic surgeons that they found that laparoscopic surgeons that had played video games when they were younger were actually about 60% faster and 60% more accurate at these surgeries. So, you know, if I were ever going into surgery, I would make sure my surgeon had played video games in the past. But I also think that you know, when we look at the mediums that we offer with video games, this is one example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kids play video games for 3-4 hours a day, and that's long-form storytelling. And I think that what we need to do is not tell them not to do this and to sit and read books, is that we need to figure out how to make these video games more educational, more immersive, and really help these kids learn in this new light that is actually engaging for their brains.
Your newspaper, the New York Times, had a big page one story just this week on people losing their ability to concentrate, to focus on anything, to interact with even their own family members, to keep track of important things in their life because they were sort of wired and twitching all the time off their BlackBerry and their iPhone and their, you know, screens or multi-screens and iPad and all the rest. I mean, it seemed to be the counter-argument to the upside that you're presenting here, Nick.
Yeah, I read that article, and I don't necessarily know if I agree with everything in it. I think that that's an extreme. You know, it's like certain people can have one glass of wine and with dinner, and that's it. And certain people are alcoholics. And I think that when you look at the way our brains are wired and the way our brains work, there are certain people that I think do take this wired world to a complete extreme that is probably not healthy for them. You know, in my book, the reason it's called I Live in the Future is because I've been on computers since I was a little kid. I got my first Spectrum when I was 4 years old. Mm-hmm. I got my first video game system when I was five. And I still sit and read long-form books and I engage with old media and things like that. But I also embrace Twitter and Facebook and all these things. And I think they've really changed the way I consume and I communicate with people. I mean, one of the great things about a blog, and Nicholas will speak to this too, I'm sure, on his blog, is the ability to actually have a conversation. And I think that the printed page and things like that really kind of locked us into this world where it was a one-way conversation.
Nick Bilton, stand by New York for a second. I want to get Nicholas Carr to jump in here from Boulder, Colorado. Nicholas, you're listening. And Nick Bilton is describing some of the upside if you're a laparoscopic surgeon or perhaps if you're that air traffic controller. And he finds that his own lifelong wired interaction practically has not left him handicapped when it comes to deeper thought. But is it possible you're talking about two different kinds of mental life? I mean, you quote, he says there's upside. You quote Michael Merzenich saying that the long-term effects on the quality of our intellectual lives, and this is a big thinker, could be deadly. That's pretty serious sounding.
I think what he's referring to, Merzenich, and it's what I spend most of my time talking about, isn't the kind of rapid-paced shifts in attention that we may be learning, as children playing video games 3 or 4 hours a day. And I don't deny that as you play video games, you get better at video games. You are able to shift your focus on the screen more quickly and have better hand-eye coordination, and that's good and that's great. But I do think that there are higher modes of thought, and those require attentiveness. Those require tuning out distractions and following one line of thought. And Nick Bilton says he can play video games and spend a lot of time online and still sit back and read long books. And I think that's great. But my own experience is very different, and other people's too. And if you look at the statistics about how we're spending our time these days, you can see that our time online is going up very rapidly. Our time watching TV continues to go up. It hit its peak, all-time peak last year. But what's collapsing is the time we spend reading printed words. And it's the printed word, I think, not only the printed word, but the printed word is a technology that encourages, I believe, the deepest kind of thinking. It shields us from distractions.
And you
in
mean
a way,
book length. You don't mean tweet posts or tweets or
right.
There's, blog posts.
You know, I think you could make an argument that if you define reading as number of words consumed, we may well be reading more than we did 20 years ago. Since, one of the most amazing things, recent changes in technology is our phones have been transformed from speaking devices to texting devices. Mm-hmm. So we're processing a huge number of words today, but all reading is not the same. If you're reading a text or a tweet, or if you're reading a little snippet online and then hopping to another snippet, that's a very different mode of reading than actually sitting down and reading a series of pages with one narrative or one line of argument and thinking about that.
So you're really describing human beings as almost in the grip of new technology being taken down a kind of devolution path rather than evolution. I want to hear from our listeners. Let's go to Knoxville, Tennessee, and Edmund. Edmund, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am calling to probably represent this side of thought that I see what is happening as a really, in the cognitive terms, mm-hmm. the evolution. And my opinion is that I don't think we can do much to change. I actually think we need to embrace this change and rather devise the methods and to get a better understanding of what is really happening to our brains, because it's like talking on a cell phone while driving. I don't think it's going to go away. I think that we're going to be more distracted, and in my opinion, we probably need to spend more time cognitively engineering the methods and means. How can we make this rewiring of our brains, or what's going to come to the next generation, more probably either efficient or more helpful to the humankind, rather than the letting Facebook take over all the time we spend distracted.
So you think we may be more distracted, but it may not be a problem. We'll adapt to it. We'll find the best in this new way.
Yeah, I believe I'm a computational cognitive scientist, and I do believe that's my position in my research as well, that we will adapt. I think that our brains will go into the process of rewiring, so the generations that come will have a brains, or at least cognitive processes that are more optimized for this kind of lifestyle. But I don't think this lifestyle is going to go away. I believe that we just need to be more focused on how do we embrace discover what's the best for our brains and what's the best for our cognitive processes.
Edmund, you're great, and I'm very grateful for your call. Nick Bilton, this is, I think, kind of singing your tune here. We're not going to get away from this. And Edmund says, let's just learn how to maximize it, as if in that plasticity that Nicholas Carr talks about, our brain can encompass this without being diminished.
Well, I mean, if you look at the research, I mean, Marianne Wolfe wrote this book, Proust and the Squid, and the opening of her book, it was a 7-year research project about how we learn to read. And the opening of her book says, you know, that she came to this really unsatisfying answer that we were never actually born to read. Our brains are not designed to read. We're designed to communicate, and we're designed to run through the jungle and things like that, we're not designed to read.
So, I mean, it's a good thing we learned how, right?
You're not. Well, but when we make this argument that our brains are not designed for computers and our and video games and all these things, our brains were never designed to read. So how can we say that reading is a better experience than computers and so on? I think that our brains adapt, and there's research that shows that they do. I mean, if you look at the plasticity and so on, this shows it. And I think in the other respect, you know, if we look back through time, this is the same kind of argument we've heard with every single technology. You know, we heard it. There's a great article, 1876, July 22nd is the day the telephone was written about in the New York Times. And the article says literally that people will never leave their house again, and they will never go to concert halls, and they'll never go to churches.
We're
and
doomed.
That's completely the opposite. You know, it says that we're doomed, and that as a society we'll never communicate well with each other. I went to a concert a few weeks ago with 100,000 people. I mean, it's the complete opposite of what we imagined back then, and I think that we're going through the same process right now with the computers and the internet and video games.
Were they all texting while they were at the concert?
Well, it was amazing, actually. Everyone was videotaping and uploading to YouTube and sharing with their friends, and I thought that was pretty amazing that people were doing that.
Nicholas Carr, is this step, this generation of technology change that we're in the midst of, different from those? This is, of course, you know, the very steady reply to your warnings that, you know, every single thing, right back to Socrates in the book, every single advance has been met with dire predictions of what it would mean for humans, and yet we accumulate and move on.
I think every time there's a new technology comes along, particularly information technology, communications technology, there are, on the one hand, great predictions of a coming utopia, and on the other side, great predictions of, you know, coming total disaster for the human race. And it's true that rarely do either of those pan out. But first of all, what I'm talking about isn't some prediction about the future. It's what we're doing today already, and what we've been going towards for 10, 15 years. And second, I think you have to look at the internet and related technologies on their own terms, and not try to dismiss concerns because people have had concerns in the past. One thing we see with the net is that it's what I call a universal medium, which means unlike TV, which could just basically broadcast moving pictures, unlike radio, which broadcasts sound, the net broadcasts everything, transmits everything, including text. It turns text itself into a content to be broadcast and exchanged in a very rapid way. And it's no surprise, seeing it in those terms, that we're beginning to use the net for pretty much everything. And so the net, more than, I would argue, more than any earlier technology, at least since the book, is having a very large effect on the way we think, simply because we are using it, we are coming to depend on it so heavily for all sorts of information. So I wouldn't be quick to, you know, look back to Socrates' concerns about writing and say that since all of those concerns didn't pan out, we should think everything mm-hmm. today with Annette is going swimmingly.
Let's go to Dylan in Barnard, Vermont. Dylan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, you know, I've grown up, I'm 21 years old, okay. and I've grown up with all this technology yep. as a part of my everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, I find this premise very scary. And the more I think about it, the more I feel like it could be true that these technologies detract from maybe my being creative. And there's been a lot of talk about reading books, but what about things like writing or drawing or painting, being creative? That was something that was mentioned earlier.
Yep.
I don't think it just boils down to writing, does it?
Let me ask you, if I may, while we've got you, Dylan. I've got a question here from Facebook, from Rita. Maybe you can answer. She says, she's thinking about this whole premise. Do college students still have those deep philosophical cafe chats that where so much was learned, or do they just text about stuff, or do they have the conversations at all? I mean, when you look at your peers, Dylan, do you feel like you've got a rich life of thought and contemplation, or you're the generation raised in this? Do you see something different?
As much as I have had many a good conversation with friends, I also see people constantly checking their cell phones, constantly texting. There's a lot of that going on. And I think that it's ruining our brains in certain ways, because you often see people check their cell phones when there's nothing to check. It's just because they think they're vibrating or they're ringing, you know?
Right.
They hear someone else's phone ring. So I think it's detrimental to our mental health in many ways, and we're going to continue down that path. If we don't look at this, you know, from the proper point of view.
Dylan, thanks for calling. Nicholas Carr, first to Dylan's question on a wider swath of creativity. Are you making a bigger case that it's not just the ability to read a book, but then to produce, to create, that's somehow, hinging on this?
I do. I mean, you know, my own experience, I first noticed it when I tried to sit down and read, because throughout my life, up until recently, I've been a big book reader and a great fan of reading. So I felt it on the reading side. But I think he's absolutely right that this isn't just about reading. This is about the ability to pay deep cognitive mental attention to one thing. And I think, you know, in order to create great works of art, to create very high, you know, to think big thoughts about science, all of these things hinge on our ability to concentrate, to pay attention. And as that capacity erodes, I do think we're going to see a narrowing of human expressiveness, whatever form that might take.
Nick Bilton, we've just got half a minute before the break, but what about Dylan's concern that he sees in himself and his peers as kind of obsessive, you know, must check, whether it's Twitter or text or whatever? Do you concede anything on that front, or do you see that as no problem, Nick?
I mean, I think that to a certain degree, yes. I mean, but we're still learning about how to use these technologies, you know, these new devices that come out every day. And I think part of the problem is that we've built these alerts too well. You know, uh-huh. when you get a text message, your phone vibrates, it blings, it's like being zapped with a taser almost. And of course, that's gonna detract from your attention. But I think at the same time, when you look at the way we communicate by text, when we send these LOLs and uh-huh. BRBs, it's a new form of communication. And I think it's we should really embrace what this is doing.
Go to Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, and Tony. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to bring up a point that I believe this is more of a generational issue in how people work with technologies and incorporate technologies into their lifestyles. I'm a web developer. I'm 30 years old or thereabouts, and I've grown up with technology, but not the high-capacity technology that youth nowadays has access to when they're 5 or 6 years old, iPods and such.
Mm-hmm.
However, I've also worked with 40, 50, and 60-year-old programmers who they accept the technology because it's acquired for the app, you know, what they're doing, what they're applying it to.
Right.
but not necessarily have integrated it into their lives on a daily basis, or can say that they liked it better than how they used to work before that technology was acquired through their job.
But Tony, let me ask you, Nicholas Carr makes the case that if you are deeply integrating this into your life, you're diminishing your mental life. You may be comfortable with it, but you may also be diminished. What do you think of that?
Well, I have a philosophy degree. I continue to write on my own. I continue to read long form. My younger brother, who's 21, he's also a developer and way more engrossed in the day-to-day activities of technology than I am. And yet we have wonderful conversations about all sorts of things.
Tony in Oklahoma, I appreciate your call. Nicholas Carr, here's another along that line from Barbara, again on Facebook, says, I can still sit all day in deep focus to read a good book and forget all about my email, Facebook, and the like, which is amazing because I'm a total internet junkie, she writes. A good story, though, can always pull me away from anything electronic. Two sort of issues there. One, generational. Is this just resistance from a generation that's not adapted? And two, you know, what about people, Nicholas, who say, hey, I can have both of these realms?
I think one of the wonderful things about the human brain is that no two are exactly alike.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there will be people who can spend hours online texting, video gaming, and then tune everything out and sit back and read Moby Dick for 3 hours or 4 hours. And I think that's great. But I don't think that's typical of where we're headed as a society, and I don't think it's typical of most people's experience. I'm not entirely comfortable with putting this with looking at this as fundamentally a generational issue. I know when I was a kid, there were adults who didn't much like the way I spent my time, and I think too often adults today kind of look at kids' use of text messaging and the web in similar terms. And there's a bit of a hypocrisy there, because if you look at the actual statistics, it's people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, even 50s who are actually on the internet, on the web, more frequently than teenagers. So this is if as adults we try to say, oh, this is, a problem for kids, we're fooling ourselves. And all you have to do is look at the way adults, you know, persistently check their Blackberries or their iPads or iPhones. You know, these are changes that are really affecting all of us, I think, and we shouldn't. And there are different effects with the young and older people, but we shouldn't see this in purely generational terms.
You're describing the individual usage there and impact, but you spoke just there of where we're headed as a society. Pull back the curtain. Where do you think, if your critical, concerned perspective here is correct, where do you think we are headed as a society with the changes that this technology may engender?
I think the earlier caller who made the point that, you know, nobody's going to pull the plug on the internet and we're probably continuing to head down this path is right.
Therefore what?
I think as a society we're going to continue to move toward not only toward a way of thinking that emphasizes very scattered, very quick and I think superficial thinking, but we're going to begin, and I think we see this already, and this has happened with past technologies, we're going to begin to redefine our intellectual lives along those terms. And you can see this already in that when people talk about the net in particular, they focus on how much information we can find and how quickly we can find it. And this is, this becomes the end, so to speak, of our thought process. How quickly can we find information? How much information is out there? What we're no longer talking about is what we do with the information once we find it. How deeply do we think about it? How creatively do we think about it? How do we connect it with the other information inside our minds and inside our memories? That side of intelligence, what you do with information, used to be considered the center of our intellectual lives. And now increasingly we're redefining those lives in the terms of the net and in terms of computers, that it's all about simply maximizing our intake of information.
Nick Bilton, what about that? What if the web leads us to roll back the tape? You said our brains are not designed to read. Of course, civilization came with reading. Could we be, you know, winding back the tape and becoming, I don't know, hunter-gatherers again, in the, you know, as our brains are shaped by the web?
Well, I think if you look at the neuroscience research, you know, when we engage in different types of mediums, our brains work in different ways. So, you know, video games, they promote memory and hand-eye coordination. Radio, you know, helps us understand and think creatively and think about words and how they're pronounced and so on. When you think about reading, you know, it really, really draws creativity and areas of our brain that help us think about things in what Nicholas is talking about in this deep form. And I think that for me, the ultimate storytelling experience would be to actually put all those together on the web in the way that it's happening now. I mean, you referenced earlier this article that the Times ran about multitasking and so on. And the thing for me that was so fascinating about that article was that there was interactive photos, there was commenting.
This family had media everywhere, but there was a lot of complaint. The wife says, you know, he doesn't interact with us anymore, talking about the husband. He's lost in the music when he's emotionally upset, he retreats into a video game rather than engaging more deeply.
Well, but why is a video game not deep? I mean, that's my question. When I've spent 12 hours blogging, I come home and sometimes I'll sit and read a book and on my iPad, of course. But sometimes I'll come home and I'll play a video game for 3 hours. And I think that what's wrong with that? For me, maybe what the problem is the fact that we haven't actually adapted these technologies to offer more information within them. So you know, when we look at kids that, let's just say, a history class in school, that they have to plod through this thick history book that is not designed for kids to really engage with in a creative way, why couldn't they play a video game for 2 hours in class about World War II, where they actually are in the game and they're a part of that experience and they're really immersed in the whole conversation of what this kind of storytelling offers.
Let's talk with an educator right here, Wendy in Memphis, Tennessee. Hi, Wendy. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi. What's your experience?
Well, I'm a college professor, and I try to sort of ride the fence here. I think that it is both a good thing and a bad thing in the sense that initially, yes, students, I have to fight their urges to text during class. But at the same time, I require them to do blogging, and I require them to do internet searching using deep search engines, not just, you know, Wikipedia is off the table for me. But I think that what it teaches them is that they are a part of a sort of global conversation, and it puts their thinking and their writing and their production of ideas in a global context that I think sort of transcends what my experience was. You're sort of this lone scholar when you're sitting in front of a book. I'm a writer, so I like books a lot. And I require books. I make them read long books, not just essays or textbooks.
Right,
but,
right.
So I try to do both. And I think that's kind of the way that we're going to have to approach this as educators, is to harness what they want and then force them past the 140-character inclination.
But what about, Professor Wendy, what about Nicholas Carr's argument that the medium itself, the technology itself, sort of inexorably pushes toward the scattered, the quick, the superficial in thought?
Well, I think that is true in a sense, but it also is pushing us toward an idea of how things are connected, and so we are looking more broadly for connections instead of just following sort of a myopic path that our current educational system pushes us down. And so when we're looking around us for those quick connections, I do see my students do that, but then I watch them land, and they, you know, based on their interests, and the diversification of information has allowed them to find out exactly what they're interested in, and then they do go for it.
Yeah, Wendy, you've got
require harnessing.
Yeah, you've got a great perspective, and I appreciate it, Nicholas Carr. How about it? That the value of that connectedness that comes with this medium, versus, you know, sort of lost in the stacks in the library, all alone, the lone, you know, shut off scholar.
I'd be lying if I claimed not to have gotten a lot of pleasure and a lot of usefulness out of the net and out of the web, and some of that comes from the great deal of connectedness we get, the ability to communicate very quickly with all sorts of people, to read other people's views and to find information quickly. And I all of those are very good things. And also, by the way, they're the big reasons we spend so much time online,
right?
Because it is pleasurable. But that's a different issue from the issue of what kind of thinking is this medium encouraging. And frankly, you know, I think there's something to be said for the solitary, quiet modes of thought, whether they take place in the stacks of a library or in your bedroom or in your living room or whatever. And and if those modes of thought, and I fear this is happening, get pushed aside in our rush to enjoy the pleasures of the web, then I fear we're going to lose a very big part of what gives our lives, in particular our intellectual lives, and even our personalities, their distinctiveness, their richness, their memorability, and so forth.
Well, so much on the line, on the table here. A couple more calls if I can. Diana in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Diana, you're on the air.
Thanks for having me on. Mm-hmm. I read that article about the damage from an addiction to electronic media and internet yesterday in the New York Times.
Yes.
It was horrifying.
Yeah.
For me, the punchline was that our capacity as human beings to empathize is going to be compromised. And I was wondering if Nick Carr could comment on not just modes of thinking, but as humans, sort of empathy. Where we're going, I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Diana. Empathy, I'll take it to both Nicks, but Nicholas Carr, first to you. Does it take a hit or not in the connectedness?
Well, in the article the woman is talking about, there was at the end Clifford Nass, who is a professor at Stanford University who's done a lot of research on multitasking, raised the fear, and I think at this point it's only a fear that. When we juggle lots of things at once, when we're handling lots of interruptions and lots of messages, we never slow down enough to kind of experience some of our deepest emotions. And it's true that studies have shown that kind of the deepest forms of empathy not just with physical suffering, say, but with what other people are thinking, how they might be suffering intellectually, and so forth. These require the thought processes are quite slow to engender that kind of empathy. So, you know, I've been attacked enough for what I've said, so I'm not going to go out and say that the web is undermining our moral sense or anything. But I do think that there may be a connection with not only the depth of our thought, but the depth of our emotions and our ability to pay deep attention to something. So to the extent we're becoming distracted all the time, then it could very well have an effect on our emotions and even our empathy.
Nick Bilton, how about it? I mean, the main guy in the Times article, his wife, Brenda, says it seems he's on, you know, wired all the time. She says it seems like he can no longer be fully in the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I fundamentally disagree with it. I think that, you know, I grew up with computers and then and the web became a part of my life as the web grew. And the way it connects me to people is just – it's just mind-boggling. I mean, mm-hmm. I have friends all over the world that I've – some I've never even met. You know, I have friends that share information and news and long-form content with me that – and I completely trust their values and their judgments. And I've never met them in my entire life. And it offers a type of communication and empathy and sympathy and whatever you want to call it that I think that we've never had before. And if you want to look at that article, I mean, imagine if you replaced every time that they talked about the internet or devices with a book. I mean, so if the guy was a bookworm, she'd probably be saying the same thing.
He's always reading. He won't talk
You know, he's
to
always
me.
Reading. He doesn't talk to me and things like that. So I don't think it's necessarily, like I said before, like I don't think it's necessarily the technology. I think it's the personality. And I think that Nicholas has really, really spoken about this, and he wrote about this in his book, that, you know, our brains are all built differently. There's certain people that I think will always want to have access to paper and long-form reading like that. And I think there's other people that their brains just aren't built that way, and then for them that a more immersive web-like experience is going to be what they want.
Maybe there's a new generation. I've got one more caller I can't get to here, but Nathan, who's 18, saying he's pro-technology, and he and his friends, you know, very often stumble upon deeper conversations because of that very kind of foraging that's going on online. Nicholas Carr, Nick Bilton was pointing out research that said our brains are not designed to read. So we've only got a minute here, but does that mean we had to develop that capacity? Do you think it's going to go away? Maybe we'll build new muscles to deal with this whole new realm of technology.
The fact that we taught ourselves to read and instilled in our brains the discipline to read, and particularly to read long-form works, was one of the great triumphs of intellectual history and underpinned many of the great triumphs of culture. So the fact that that's not natural is in no way a bad thing. I mean, the fact that we were able to get beyond our natural limitations and instincts is a very good thing. And if we lose that, that would be a devastating loss.
Well, that puts a version of the stakes right on the line. This is a conversation that will go on for a long time. We're grateful to each of you for helping us with it today. Nick Bilton with the New York Times joining us from New York. His new book, look for it this fall. It's I Live in the Future and Here's How It Works. Nick Bilton, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Nicholas Carr with us today from Boulder, Colorado, author of The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. Read an excerpt at our website. Nicholas Carr, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.